everybody. So our chapter 4 assignment is due this Friday. We're going to get through the rest of chapter 4 today. We just have some reaction writing to do, learn a bit about titration calculations, and we'll do redox. So should be able to make it through that. You've got the experiment 5 lab report due this upcoming Monday. So we'll make sure that gets turned in on time. I'm going to get the next round of graded lab reports. So I have two written reports that you've turned in to me that I have to grade. So I'm going to try to get at least one of them to you on Friday. The other might come over the weekend. So same place as before. Look in your Dropbox if you submitted it. You know, they'll be returned in there. So I think that's it. Yeah, that's about it. Anybody have any questions before we get going? The end of last time, let's just bring this up. End of last time, I had my conductivity probe and we were testing these different solutions. We found that some were non-electrolytes, some were electrolytes. The electrolytes are the solutions that conduct electricity. But what is the key difference between electrolytes and non-electrolytes?
Electrolytes are ionic.
Yes, electrolytes are ionic. Non-electrolytes are molecular. Right? That's a distinction we've made between types of compounds before. So the substances that are made of ions, when they dissolve in water, they will cause the water to conduct electricity. That is because not only are electrolytes themselves just made out of ions, but the electrolytes dissociate into free ions when they're dissolved in water. So the ions separate from each other. So if I have sodium chloride solid, that's what this is in the middle here. Can't see my pointer, but sodium chloride solid is an ionic lattice with those oppositely charged ions all stacked together in nice, neat rows and columns. Okay. When I put it in water and stir it up, the sodium ions will separate from the chloride ions. So if I'm writing out what actually forms, what actually is produced when sodium chloride dissolves in water, I make Na what? Na plus? Na plus with what phase label? Aq. Na plus Aq plus what? Cl minus. Okay? That's important. These are the dissolved ions. And this is a picture of what that would actually look like if we could get down on that level and see those ions and molecules, right? So here's undissolved solid that just hasn't made it yet. If we look at towards the edges of that solid, though, these ions are being pulled apart from the rest of the solid, okay? The minus is the chloride, the plus is the sodium. And look at what has happened to the ions once they've been pulled away from the solid. Okay? What are these red and white ones? Yeah, those are the water molecules. So what did the water molecules do to this sodium ion right here? Yeah. I mean, they're not actually forming a chemical bond, but they're attracted to it by the opposite charges. Right? When we talk about polarity of molecules, we'll see why that is. But the minus end of the water molecule is attracted to this positive ion. And look at the minus ion, the chloride. It's surrounded by water molecules also, just sort of the same, the opposite direction. The important thing for us to see here is that those ions have separated. From the rest of the solid, they are surrounded by water molecules. solution. So this is a solution that would conduct electricity because it has charged particles that are dissolved throughout it.
Go ahead. How would the electricity flow through?
Ooh, that's a good question. Say I have two electrodes that I put into that solution. One of them, just hook it up to a battery, one of them would have a positive charge to it, and one of them would have a negative charge to it. Let's just imagine the positively charged electrode that I put in there. What of those ions, right? I have positive and negative ions there. What's going to happen to those ions, to one of those ions, in relationship to that positive electrode?
What do you think?
Yeah, the negative ions will be attracted to the positive electrode. Okay? The positive ions, what will they do? They'll be attracted to the negative electrode. So it actually causes those ions to move and to gravitate towards those electrodes. The fact that that negative ion moves towards the positive electrode, it sort of sets up a transport of electrons, right? The negative electrode has extra electrons to give away. It can give those to the positive ion. The negative ion can go over to the other electrode and sort of give its electrons away. So it's indirect. There aren't electrons actually traveling their way through the liquid. It's through those charged particles, the motion of those charged particles, that the current is able to flow. And I think that's kind of neat. So, but that's a key right there. There's another thing where on the molecular level we can explain a behavior that we can observe on the macroscopic, on the experimental level. So ionic substances that break up into these positive and negative ions, will conduct electricity because those ions can be attracted to the electrodes. So these are molecules of sugar. Okay? So just a big, they look like, in this case, just a big clump of atoms, but it's a couple rings of carbon with hydrogens and oxygens on them, but it's just a big molecule. When sugar dissolves, it stays as sugar molecules. They're no longer crystalline, so those molecules aren't all stacked up, but we still have just those same molecules. So no charged particles, no ions have been dissolved in this solution. Okay? So will this solution conduct electricity? No. I can put a plus electrode and a minus electrode over on those sides, and those sugar molecules won't even care about it. Okay? They'll just be floating around dissolving. So it's the fact that we have those ions allow electricity to be conducted. Okay. Does that make sense? This idea that when an ionic compound dissolves, its ions separate will be an important concept for us coming up.
So if you get a bicarbonate and stay as HCO, whatever it is?
So if you had sodium bicarbonate,
yeah,
that's an ionic compound that would dissociate into sodium ions and to bicarbonate ions. So any plus minus compound that is soluble will form those positive and negative
ions. So water breaks ionic bonds, but not negative bonds.
That's exactly right. Water can replace ionic bonds by grouping around the ions like that. Okay? So the water is able to surround those ions and sort of replace some of the interactions that they felt with the opposite ions.
When they water molecules, they circle around.
They surround them, yeah. They make a whole sphere right around that ion.
Does a certain end of the water molecule?
Yep, absolutely. If you look closely, here's the plus ion. What part of the water molecule is facing the plus? The oxygens. Here's the minus ion. What part of the water molecules is facing the minus? The hydrogen. Okay? So we're not talking about polarity of molecules just yet, but within those water molecules, there's a more minus side and a more plus side because of the electronegativity of those elements. So anytime it's a polar molecule, the proper side will be attracted to those ions. So, all right. So we'll come back to acids in just a second, but acids are a little bit different because they're molecules that actually dissociate. So the sugar molecules that we had back there, they just stayed as sugar molecules. But acids are real molecules that dissociate. They make H plus and a negative ion. So acids are the special case of a type of molecule that actually dissociates. And we'll get to those in a second. The term strong electrolyte is a term we can use for a substance that completely breaks apart into its ions. Dissociation means just breaking apart. So if I put sodium chloride in, just like we wrote on the last page, we get Na plus ions and Cl minus ions. HCl is an acid that is a strong electrolyte. So what two ions will be formed when HCl dissolves in water? H plus and chloride. Okay. Those are strong electrolytes where we can assume that they've completely dissociated. We have none of the full molecules or full or ionic lattice. We have none of them joined together anymore once it's dissolved. That makes sense? So weak electrolytes are the opposite. Weak electrolytes do not completely dissociate into ions. So this is acetic acid, an acid that we'll use as an example many, many, many times this semester and next semester. It's a common, very common acid. Anybody know what acetic acid is in? What grocery store supply contains? What's that? Wine?
Vinegar.
Vinegar, yeah. Vinegar does. Vinegar is just a 5% solution of acetic acid. So very common, and that's why we talk about it. But look at this. I have forward and minus arrows, which means that this can go both directions. Okay? Acetic acid can dissociate into an H plus and an acetate ion, but the reverse happens also. If I have undissociated, if I have these separate ions in solution, they can group back together and form the molecule. And in the case of a weak electrolyte, the key is that the solution contains mostly complete molecules. Okay. So when I have that forward and reverse arrow, it's called an equilibrium. Okay. When we have both directions. If my solution contains mostly the complete molecules, which side of this equilibrium is favored? The left side or the right side? Yeah, the left side. Okay. In the case of a weak electrolyte, okay, we have mostly the complete molecules. There will be a small amount of undissociated, or a small amount of these separate ions. Most of it will be undissociated. Most of it will be complete molecules. So if we think back to our conductivity probe, I put sodium chloride in. That conducted a lot of electricity. It went up to 250 or something high like that. The non-electrolytes were right around zero. What do you suppose a weak electrolyte would do? Yeah, it's going to be somewhere in between. It's going to be closer to the non-electrolytes because the solution contains mostly those complete molecules. So it'll be closer to a molecular, closer to a non-electrolyte. But it will conduct some electricity. Okay? So if I were to, if I brought my stuff back and I put that probe in vinegar, it would conduct more than the sugar did, more than the acetone did, but not nearly as much as the sodium chloride did. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Would that be like closer to like the tap water?
Yeah. Well, the other thing that affects conductivity is actually how many ions there are. Tap water has dissolved ions, but the concentration of them is very low compared to that salt water I made where I dumped salt in there. Okay. So there may be some weak electrolytes in there, but mostly what that tap water was strong electrolytes just at a very low concentration. But we'd probably see about the same result that way, because the conductivity is really just measuring how many ions there are floating in solution. Okay, hang on.
So then, look at the negative impacts of electrolytes in
Yep. Only those that have dissociated will be attracted, right? So you'll have vinegar, you'll have a small percentage of the molecules that have made these ions. Whatever ions there are in that solution, though, will be attracted to the two electrodes. So putting the electrodes in there doesn't change this equilibrium. It just takes those ions that already had been dissociated and moves them either way. So, but since there will be fewer ions overall, there will be less electricity that's conducted. That makes sense? What's that? Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll learn all about that. When do we learn that? We'll talk a little bit about that in the bonding chapter later. We'll talk mostly about it in the acid-base equilibrium chapter in second semester. So, stick around, right? So, we learned if an ionic compound dissolves, okay, it has free ions that can conduct electricity. But not all ionic compounds dissolve in water. Okay? The ones that do are strong electrolytes. So that was the sodium chloride. I poured it in, it dissolved, it made it conduct electricity. There are ionic compounds that do not dissolve. They remain as a solid ionic lattice when they're added to water. So in lab, we talked a little bit about that. Something like calcium carbonate, which is chalk dust. If you poured that into water, you could stir and stir and stir and stir, and it would just settle right back down to the bottom. It would not dissolve. So here are examples of those two cases. Here's some silver nitrate. Okay? Silver nitrate is AQ when it's dissolved because it breaks up into silver ions and to nitrate ions. Silver chloride will not dissolve. If I had silver chloride and I poured it in, it would just be like that chalk dust. You could make a suspension, but it would never actually dissolve. It remains as this orderly, compact ionic lattice. Okay? So let's think about that in terms of conducting electricity. Put my electrode in here. Does this one conduct electricity? Yes, does an excellent job. Put my electrodes in here. Does this one? No. What do we need to conduct electricity? Ions where? Ions that are dissolved, ions that are separate, floating in the solution, able to move independently of each other. Right? So this one will not, really to any appreciable extent, does not conduct. Now, even those molecular substances we had yesterday did a little bit of conductivity, but that was probably just from impurities, right? Other things that might have been in them. This one, when it's solid like that, there's going to be a couple of ions, a very small amount of ions that might make their way out. So it will conduct a tiny bit of electricity, but it'll be insignificant, just like the molecular ones we had. No. That's a good question. Let me answer your question with this sentence. The following table will be given on the exam without the formulas in parentheses. So I'll give you this entire table, but I will delete these formulas. I do that because I have to be able to know that you have memorized the polyatomic ions. Right? So nitrate, acetate, chloride, bromide, iodide, sulfate. This is pretty much identical to the printout that I gave you in lab. Okay? So if you're studying, right, I'll have it up on the web page. I'll have one that you can print out without those things in parentheses, so you can use that for your practice. Okay? So don't need to memorize any rules. You do, however, need to know that sulfate is SO42-. Okay? So what this till? I'm sorry. I will give you these. The ones in parentheses, I'll leave out. So just look at what's in parentheses. I give you those on here just to speed things up a little bit. But on the exam, the parenthetical ones will be deleted. Okay? So this tells us which ionic compounds dissolve and which don't. Okay? Which ionic compounds break apart into their ions? Which stay together in an ionic lattice? What do you suppose determines that? What holds an ionic lattice together? Solid ionic compounds like sodium chloride, NaCl, NaCl, NaCl. What's holding those ions together? Yeah, ionic charges, positive and negative charges. Water molecules are able to come in and sort of pull those ions off of the edge by surrounding them. But if I have an insoluble ionic compound, one that does not get pulled apart, what do you suppose that means about its ionic bonds? Yeah, some ionic compounds have ionic bonds that are strong enough so that water cannot pull those ions apart. Okay. We'll see down here, these ones, right? If we have lithium, sodium, potassium, ammonium, if we have nitrate, acetate, if those appear at all within the ionic compound, it will dissolve. So what do you suppose that means about the ionic bonds that these four are able to form? Yeah, they're relatively weak ionic bonds, okay, in the scope of ionic compounds. Down here on the bottom, things like hydroxide, sulfide, carbonate, phosphate, those are mostly insoluble. What do you suppose that means about their ionic bonds? Stronger. You notice something in common with these, especially sulfide, carbonate, phosphate versus lithium, sodium, potassium versus those? Yeah. These have bigger charges to them. If I have ions with 2 plus and 2 minus charges, that's a stronger ionic bond than something with 1 plus and 1 minus. So as sort of a general rule, the bigger the charge, right, the bigger the magnitude of that charge, the stronger they're held together. That's why these insoluble ones tend to have larger charges to them. I'm sorry? Why is hydroxide? Hydroxide is a little different. And when we talk about acids and bases a little bit later on, hydroxide will come into play. It can form, and due to it's mostly because of its size and its shape, it's able to fit really well into an ionic lattice to make strong ionic bonds. You have a question, Hudson? If you heat silver chloride until it melts, then what phase label is it? It's L. It has, so you'll have ions that are moving around each other. If I put an electrode into molten silver chloride, would that conduct electricity or not? What was our requirement for conducting?
Ions be able, for the units to be able to move.
Mm-hmm. We need ions that are able to move freely towards the electrodes. So if I have molten silver chloride, would it conduct electricity? Yes, absolutely. Molten ionic compounds do conduct electricity. And that's actually how, it's the process of electrolysis. That's how many pure elements are formed. So pure sodium is formed by taking molten sodium chloride and giving it a really high voltage electrical charge to it through those two electrodes. So chlorine will actually collect at one electrode and sodium metal will actually collect at the other one because of that flow of electrons. So,
but they won't dissolve still.
If you tried to pour that into water, the water would just all boil and evaporate and explode all over. So molten salts are nasty things. Molten salts will themselves dissolve about anything. So they're not to be taken lightly, I guess. So you guys all use the table like this in lab. The key is, I'll just remind you, the key is to look down this left column first to find one of the ions in your compound, and then just look across to see if your particular compound is an exception to that. Okay? So if I had, say, let me just give you a couple of examples. If I had calcium nitrate, what phase label would it get? Right. You'd look over here, nothing about calcium here, but nitrate says that there are no exceptions to the fact that it's soluble. So So if you're over here, and it's not an exception, you're AQ. Right? But what if I had calcium sulfate? What would that be? Most compounds containing sulfate are soluble, right? So AQ? No, I have to look over here. Calcium is an exception. When sulfate pairs with any of these, the compound is insoluble. Why does insoluble get an S phase label? Because it's a solid. If it doesn't dissolve, it's a solid. Okay? It'll settle to the bottom. You could filter it out and you'd have that same solid. Okay? These ones over here on the left, if it's not an exception, what phase label would these get? Carbonate, phosphate, hydroxide, sulfate. As long as it's not an exception, what would we have? Solid. But if it is an exception, we'd have what? AQ. Right? This actually clarifies our hydroxide case a little bit, and we'll have to work on that a little more later on. But for this chapter anyway, goeth for many purposes. For many purposes, these may be considered insoluble. So if you've got calcium hydroxide, strontium, barium hydroxide, call those solid. Okay? That's going to be consistent, I think, with one of your observations in the experiment. Okay? So let's show you where you use that. In lab, what you did several times was have ionic compounds where you mixed the two things together and a precipitate formed. Okay? That's when two ionic compounds trade their ions and we produce a solid, insoluble product. So we've got two soluble things we mix together. By that new combination of ions, if the product is insoluble, it will precipitate. So the if you take a look here, I want to make a balanced chemical equation with phase labels for reactions of solutions of potassium iodide and lead to nitrate. Okay? So, and let's do it looking at these pictures. Here's the potassium iodide solution. Okay? Notice we've got K plus ions separate from I minus ions. What does that mean about potassium iodide? Yeah, it's a strong electrolyte, it's soluble, right? K-I-A-Q. Same thing with lead to nitrate. Right? And these came from our first solubility rules, too, that can confirm that. Anything with potassium in it is soluble. Anything with nitrate in it is soluble. But when I mix them together, and I have those four ions floating around in that same solution, there are new ion pairs that can form. Right? Take a look right here. PbI2, right, came from those lead two ions and the I minus ions. When those two ions combine together, according to this picture, what have we formed? We formed a solid, right? This is in the atomic level. Look over here at what that would look like. What do we call that when a solid has formed by mixing two solutions together? Yeah, this is a precipitate. This is a precipitate of PbI2 solid. It's actually yellow colored. That's what it looks like for real. You mix two colorless solutions together, you get this bright yellow solid precipitate. K plus and NO3 minus ions are still floating around in that solution. How come those didn't form a precipitate? Yeah, because KNO3 is soluble. Right? So the balanced chemical equation we would write would be potassium iodide and lead to nitrate. Making the new combination of ions. Remember, there was K plus and I minus, Pb 2 plus, and NO3 minus. Okay? Those are the four ions that are present within the solution. If I pair them up the other way, I get PbI2. And if I didn't have that picture, how would I know what PbI2's phase label is? Solubility rules. Right here. Iodide. Mostly soluble, but when iodide is paired with lead 2, the compound is insoluble. That combination of ions has a strong enough bonding that they're not separated by water. They join together and remain solid. So PbI2 solid, and the other pair, KNO3 AQ. I have to do one more thing before this equation is done. Put a 2 somewhere. Is it done? Maybe it is done. I don't know. Okay. There you go. Don't forget to balance it. Okay? With a balanced chemical equation. So, it is very important, though, that you balance it after you get the correct product formulas. Okay? Don't let however many things are on this side influence what you're going to write for lead iodide. Okay? It's the charges that determine that's PbI2, not how many we have here. Okay? A student that's not considering charges would incorrectly write just PbI, but PbI doesn't make sense. Okay? Because I have lead 2 plus ions, and those ions will not change their charge just because they've been dissolved. Does that make sense? So take those charges into account, make the new formulas based off of those charges. Okay? It's a huge mistake. If someone's being lazy and just trying to make them just from those formulas there, just by swapping them, you're not going to get the right formulas. So whether it's in your head or whether you're writing down what the ions are, make the new formulas based on those charges, and only then do you balance it. That makes sense? So you've got plenty of practice in lab getting those, and I checked your books. Every single one of you that I saw in lab was able to write proper precipitation reactions. So keep up with that. If all products are soluble, no reaction occurs. Okay? So if you have AQ plus AQ making AQ plus AQ, think about that in the sense of how ionic compounds have dissolved. If I have two soluble ionic compounds, what will I, and I mix them together, what will actually be present in that solution? Say I had sodium chloride and potassium nitrate, two soluble ionic compounds. What will actually be present? Yeah, of sodium and nitrate and potassium and chloride or whatever there are. I'll have those four ions all floating around. And if those possible products were soluble too, then nothing recombines. I just have four ions floating in the solution, and the reactants are no different from the products. Okay? That's why there's no reaction. A chemical reaction only occurs when something actually changes. Something goes from being dissolved ions to making a solid ionic lattice. That's a chemical change. Okay? That makes sense? So, we're doing on time. There we go. So here's just a review then of what we did during lab, especially. And there are a couple of you that weren't here for lab. You're going to want to study this extra hard because we went through it a pretty good amount in lab, and we won't talk about it quite as much today. So what I have here is a molecular equation. Sometimes it's just called the balanced chemical equation. That's just writing chemical formulas for reactants and products. No ions shown. Okay? These are all neutral compounds. The molecular equation is useful if you're going finding the things that you're going to mix together to make this reaction. Okay? We're going to find a jar of calcium nitrate, and this is what it'll say on the jar. So it'll say calcium nitrate, and I'll make some sodium sulfate together. Okay? I can make a solid product and NaNO3, even though NaNO3 will just be separate ions floating around. We still write them as compounds. Okay? That's the way the balanced chemical equation or the molecular equation. I never really liked calling it a molecular equation because there aren't really molecules here. These are ionic compounds, but we write them as if they were neutral compounds. Does that make sense? So that's just sort of the default way of doing it. The complete ionic equation, now that we have a little better definitions, we can say that any strong electrolyte are written as separate ions with their own coefficients and their own phase labels. What do strong electrolytes do when they're dissolved in water? Yeah, they conduct electricity because they have done what? They have separated. They've come apart into their ions. So we'll indicate that. Now, careful here. Pure solids, liquids, gases, weak electrolytes, and non-electrolytes will not come apart in the ionic equation. Okay? So only strong electrolytes, which means only soluble ionic compounds or strong acids, as we'll see coming up. So, calcium nitrate in the ionic equation, what do you think? Break it apart or keep it together? Break it apart. Calcium. Calcium what? Calcium 2 plus. Calcium 2 plus what? AQ. Now, this AQ did not come from solubility rules. Where did this AQ come from? Came from right here. If I have a compound that breaks into ions, those two ions will be dissolved. Okay? That's just sort of a logical conclusion that you can get to. Okay? So each ion you've separated will have its own phase label and its own coefficients if it needs it. So what will I write next? Yeah, all right, 2 nitrates. This subscript 2 just meant that if I had that ionic compound, I would need 2 nitrates for every calcium. Okay? That's how we indicate the ratio when we're writing a formula of a compound. Now that they've separated, I say I have 1 calcium ion and I have 2 nitrate ions. That's it. Okay? You only use the parentheses and the subscript when you're writing a neutral formula like that. Does that make sense? See if you can finish this. Should be able to. And these get to be pretty long. You can write it on 2 lines if you want. You can just have the reactants on 1 line and the products on another line. That's fine. I'll try to all squeeze it together. But be careful. Make sure to ask yourself, only the strong electrolytes, only the things that break apart into ions will be written as separate ions. All right. Somebody from over here to my right. What's the next ion that you wrote? Somebody over here. Sodium positive? What's that? 2 sodium positives. Okay. with what phase interval? Okay, then what? Sulfate. AQ. Okay, that's good. We had an AQ phase level. This is a soluble ionic compound, so it gets broken up. Okay. Megan or Vanessa down here in front, what'd you put as the first product? Yeah, calcium sulfate just as it is. Why?
It's solid.
Yeah, because in our equation, it's a solid. It's an ionic compound, but it is what?
Insoluble.
Insoluble, right? It's an insoluble ionic compound. So just remind yourself. Okay? Andrew, Julia, what did you put next?
Two positive sodium.
Yep, two. Okay. And then what?
Two.
Good. Okay. There's our complete ionic equation. And the complete ionic equation is a description of what's actually in the solution. So, before, when I mix things together, but before it reacts, I have those four ions floating in the solution. After the reaction has taken place, I have a solid ionic compound, but I still have those two ions floating around. Okay? So that tells us what is actually in the solution. Okay? Spectator ions do not participate in the reaction. So if I have something that is identical in the products and reactants, that's a spectator ion. So so what's one spectator ion in the back?
Sodium.
Sodium is a spectator ion. What else? That's right. The net ionic equation then only shows the things that are changing. So if you identify the spectator ions, just omit them, and you have the net ionic equation. So, Ryan or Samantha, what's the first thing I'd write in the net ionic equation? Okay. Then what? Okay. What do you think, Grigori? What's the product of the net ionic equation? Well, if I connected that would be CA. The net ionic equation should already be balanced. If it's not, then you missed the spectator ion or you didn't have it balanced in the first place. Right? This shows a chemical change. I went from two dissolved ions to now a solid ionic lattice. Those are substances with different properties, so that's a chemical change. Okay? Yeah?
When you're balancing the equation, is there a way to tell if it's a really weak electrolyte?
It's a weak electrolyte? The only weak electrolytes we'll deal with are weak acids. So we'll show you those on the next page. If it's a soluble ionic compound, it's a strong electrolyte. If it's an insoluble ionic compound, it's a non-electrolyte. If it's a molecule, it's a non-electrolyte. Okay? I'll let you guys think about this. We touched on it a little bit in lab. But if the net ionic equation is showing the chemical change that's happening, think, you know, take a little time later on sometime to think on your own what a net ionic equation would look like if there's no chemical change. So I'll just let you think that over. Let's go on to our acids and bases. Okay. Remember I told you, an acid is a molecule that dissociates and it makes an H plus and some minus ion. Okay. A base will dissociate and will produce, what's OH minus called?
Hydroxide.
Hydroxide. The bases we'll be talking about now will produce hydroxide ions in solution. Okay? So, strong acids dissociate completely. Okay? So, they are strong electrolytes, meaning they'll totally break into ions. They will conduct electricity if I have a solution of them. And there are six common strong acids that you should memorize. It's not very difficult because these three are very closely related. What's the name of HCl? Yeah, that's the most popular acid there is, hydrochloric. Okay. So, hydrochloric acid, hydrobromic, hydroiodic acid. Okay. HNO3, what's that one called? Nitric. H2SO4, sulfuric. HClO4. What's the ClO4 minus ion? Remember there's four of them?
Yeah.
So the ion is perchlorate, so the acid is perchloric. Okay.
Write that.
So, three of them are just chlorine, bromine, iodine, right in the column on the periodic table. Okay? Nitric, sulfuric, perchloric. So, you need to have those memorized because if you run into one of these in a chemical equation and you need to write an ionic equation, you need to know that these will do what when I write an ionic equation? Yeah. These are the only six acids that will break apart into ions. Okay? Weak acids are any other formula that starts with H. Okay? Really easy to identify. If it's something else that starts with H, consider it a weak acid. Okay? Hydrofluoric acid, this, you saw this before, this is acetic. What's H3PO4 called? Phosphoric. If HNO3 was nitric acid, HNO2 is what? Remember how to do that?
Nitrous.
Okay. Etc. So, if I ran into one of these in a chemical equation and I'm writing an ionic equation, what would I do with nitrous acid or phosphoric acid or something like that? What would I do? If the strong acids broke apart into ions, these will just stay as their formula. Right? They all are still AQ. Here, I'll put AQ behind all of them. Every acid is soluble. Okay? But something like this, for instance, would stay whether it's a complete or a net ionic equation. I should call them equations, not formulas. Just write that. So, don't just assume that everything that's AQ comes apart into two ions. If it's a weak acid, it actually stays, even though it's AQ. And we defined those before. Weak acids are mostly the complete molecule. They dissociate a little bit. We said that before. But since the majority of them are these complete molecules, that's how they'll be represented in ionic equations. That make sense? So you have acid-base reactions that you have to write about in your report. Some had a strong acid, some had a weak acid. You'll need to treat those properly when you're writing a complete ionic equation and a net ionic equation, right? Right?
There's no way to memorize
Yeah, memorize these six. Any other will be weak. Okay? So, just, you know, chlorine, bromine, and iodine are on the are just right together on the periodic table. Nitric and sulfuric are very commonly used acids. Most people have probably heard of them already. So perchloric, then, is just the only other one. And that's the one with four oxygens as the most oxygens of all the chlorine ones. So if you know that there are six, I bet most of you could probably fill this in if you know you're looking for six. Okay? The strong bases are soluble or slightly soluble hydroxides. So sodium, lithium, potassium, according to the solubility rules, those are completely soluble. So they'll break apart into sodium and hydroxide. Okay? Hydroxide is what we needed for a strong base. Calcium hydroxide and barium hydroxide, they're actually considered strong bases, even though they're not completely soluble. That's why those are sort of so-so. It actually depends on the concentration, whether they'll be dissolved or not. But we'll consider them to be strong bases. So unless you had evidence otherwise, like from an observation or something, you would normally break these apart. Okay? So you wrote some acid-base neutralization reactions in your lab. They work just the same as those precipitation reactions where we combine the pluses and minuses. Right? So see if we can do this. Nitric acid and calcium hydroxide. And let's just call those two AQ. Okay? If you think about it, if we consider the ions, H plus, nitrate minus, what's calcium's charge?
2+.
And what's hydroxide? Okay. What's this H plus going to pair up with in the products? Hydroxide. What do you get when you pair an H plus and a hydroxide? H plus and OH minus. Yeah. Let's just go aside there. So one of the products will be H2O liquid. Another little line didn't come through there. Here we go. I'm sorry? Yeah. I pushed it just didn't push hard enough. What's the other product going to be? Calcium nitrate? So what's that? CaNO3? Just like that? CaNO3 parentheses 2. To take those charges into account, have to do it that way. It's a nitrate, so it's aqueous. Better balance this. What should I do to balance this? Yep, because there's two nitrates over here. Then what? Two H pluses and two hydroxides make two waters. There you go. Typically, water will be one of the products of an acid-base reaction if it was a hydroxide that we mixed it with. Yeah? So, okay, we did the same plus-minus exchange. Just now, we made water as a product. That's it. We don't call this one no reaction because why? Because there was a chemical change that happened here. What is it? Water liquid. Okay. I had H plus ions combining with hydroxide ions to make water molecules. That's an actual chemical change. Okay. So, one thing that can be done with acid-base reactions is a titration. And this is an experiment that you'll be doing in a couple of weeks, I think. Next week? Next week or the week after, I don't remember. You'll be doing a titration. And all it is an acid-base reaction, but you measure the amount of the one thing that you're adding. Okay? So controlled addition of one reactant with a known concentration to another, and we do it to determine an unknown concentration. It's an analysis or an analytical technique. If I have a solution and I want to find out what its concentration is, I can do a titration to figure that out. So here is probably the simplest titration that we can imagine, where I'm titrating HCl and NaOH, hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide. There's the two products that's formed. Net ionic equation is like we talked about. H plus and hydroxide making water. What does that mean the spectator ions were?
Sodium and chloride.
Right? If this is an AQ, I have those two ions floating around that have not participated. Okay? So let's look at this picture. This is a titration setup. Up here, this is called a burette. Just a big long tube with a little valve at the bottom where you can control how much is coming out of it. Okay. In this titration, we have the sodium hydroxide. We have the hydroxide up on top. Okay. Down on the bottom, we have the acid. So, NaOH. Here is HCl. What we do is we add sodium hydroxide through that burette until the reaction is complete. And how do I know the reaction has completed? Well, yeah. It's called the equivalence point. Right? That's when we've completely reacted both of the reactants together. Right? Equal moles of those two reactants. We use an indicator. It changes color to indicate an endpoint. So phenolphthalein is a common indicator that's used. And it changes color depending on whether the solution is acidic or basic. So when it starts out, I have phenolphthalein in here already. I have HCl in that solution. Is that acidic or basic? It's acidic. Okay? So that means phenolphthalein is clear when the solution is acidic. I'm adding hydroxide. With every little bit of hydroxide that I add, I neutralize some of that acid, right? Because that's the net ionic equation. Every one hydroxide will take away one H plus, right? So eventually I'll get to the point where I've added enough hydroxides to neutralize each of those H pluses. Look what's happened here. I have just water molecules, okay? Then, if I added one more hydroxide after I've completely neutralized it, what would the solution become? Acidic? Basic. Okay. Right now it's neutral. When I've done it perfectly, it's neutral. Just one additional hydroxide will turn it basic. So you can see the color there. What does that mean about phenolphthalein? It turns pink when the solution is basic. So phenolphthalein. So when it just starts to turn pink, that means we've added enough. Okay. So it's just a visual indicator for when we've added just the right amount to neutralize, to completely react with what was in there. Okay. How does that work? It's actually an acid-base reaction itself. Phenolphthalein is a big molecule, and when the solution is basic, it gives up an H plus, and it changes the shape of that molecule, and it turns color. So. Phenolphthalein. It's just a molecule. It's a big molecule, a solution. Of what? I could draw its structure. It's, fifteen carbons. It's like C15H23O5 or something like that. So some big molecule. It's actually extracted from the leaves of a plant. So most colorful plant petals and plant flower petals and plant leaves and stuff have acid-base indicator properties. So if you extracted the red dye essentially from what's the Christmas time flower that's red?
Poinsettia.
Yeah, poinsettia. That's a really good one. You can boil it and you can extract that red color, and that will change color depending on acid base. Anybody do the red cabbage experiment? Anybody remember that? You blend up red cabbage and then you have this red cabbage juice that you can add vinegar or ammonia to or something like that, and that changes color. So a lot of those strongly colored plant compounds have those acid-base indicator properties, and phenolphthalein is just one of them. So here's a problem that we would run into. Well, it's not a problem. Here is a task, a calculation that we would do to do a titration. And it's nothing more than a stoichiometry problem, just like ones that we've done before. Okay? Remember before we had a chemical reaction, I gave you concentrations of certain amounts and you had to figure out how much was formed or something like that. That's all this is. So as long as we have a balanced equation and as long as we can organize our information together, we'll be able to figure this out. So let's read this. 25 milliliters of HCl of an unknown concentration were titrated with 12 milliliters of 0.100 molar sodium hydroxide. And the way to interpret that is that we've got HCl, 25 milliliters down in our container, and we don't know its concentration. And we add sodium hydroxide to it. Okay? We had to add 12.45 milliliters of 0.100 molar. That's how much it took to neutralize it, to make the indicator change color. Okay? So we wrote this chemical equation before, H2O liquid NaCl Q. Okay? What am I asking for? What will the unit of our final answer be? Moles? Close. Molarity? What is the molarity of the HCl? So molarity of the HCl. And what's the definition of molarity? Moles of what in this case? Moles of HCl per what? Liters, solution. Okay. I want to know how many moles of that HCl are per liter of solution. Is there anything in that fraction that I already know? I know liters of solution right here. So when we're finishing up our problem to get molarity, we were told right there, we've told that there's 25 milliliters of that HCl solution. We need to figure out how many moles are in it, though, in order to do the calculation. So this is the stoichiometry problem. What am I going to have to do? 12 milliliters, 0.100 molar sodium hydroxide. Anybody know what to start with if I'm making a conversion out of this? What do you think, Corey?
12.45.
Sounds good. Because that's a single given value that I can start with. Milliliters into
liters.
We do that a lot. Okay. liters into... Capital M means moles per liter. Okay. 1 liter of NaOH solution contains what? .10 moles of what? NaOH. Okay. But I don't want moles of NaOH, I want what? I want moles of HCl. How do you get from moles of one thing to moles of another thing? The mole ratio. What is the mole ratio in this balanced equation? Of NaOH and HCl? 1:1. Right? I'll let you type that out. But in a titration problem, it can be tough to figure out where to start. That's why I like to look at what thing you're being asked for. Whenever you're asked for a molarity, you have to have moles divided by liters. That's always the very last thing you do when I say what's the molarity. Okay? So get that set up. You realize I need moles of one thing, but I'm given information about another reactant. So that's a stoichiometry problem, like we did last time, essentially. So no need to make this any more difficult than it needs to be. You don't really even have to worry about trying to think about whether it's neutralized and any of that. We already told you how much it took to react. We told you what volume you have. So you've got all the information you need. That's it. Somebody get an answer? It's going to look an awful lot like what we started with because I only divided by 1,000 and multiplied by 0.1, right? What'd you get?
1.245 times 10 to the negative third moles of HCl.
Right. So, to answer my question, I would do what? How many moles there were inside of here? What am I going to divide that by? How many liters? Yeah. I have 25 milliliters. If you need to write this out, that's fine. 25.0 milliliters. If you want to just move the decimal point over, that's fine. All right. Molarity has to be moles per liter, so 0.0250. Is that right? Then what? Divide? Since molarity is moles per liter, I know how many moles I have in that sample. If I divide by what its volume is, that would give us moles per liter. Right? Yeah. You actually can, because that's a similar sort of relationship, but it only works if it's a 1:1 mole ratio. If it's a 1:2 mole ratio, or 2:1, or 3:1, or something like that. Careful. That's my only advice. Be careful. Okay. So, anybody get a molarity here?
I got 0.04 on your point. Did you want to round your
0.50?
Okay.
3 sig figs?
0.0498.
Yeah. So, first of all, you have to recognize when you're asked for molarity, you'll take how many moles you have divided by how many liters you have. That gives you moles per liter. So, if I had, you know, if I had 40 moles per 4 liters, that would be 10 moles per liter. Right? If you think of it in the bigger way, that makes a little more sense. Okay? So, titration, please don't make this more complicated than it actually is. I don't want to tell you that this is an easy problem because these things all require thought. You have to study it. You have to really work at it to be fluent at it. So it's not an easy question, but it's not more difficult than any of the other stuff that we've done. Okay? So don't treat it any differently than solving for molarity and then using stoichiometry to figure out moles. That makes sense? So don't expect that just this is going to get you by on that. Get the problems in the textbook and study up on those really carefully. Okay? Let me just quickly talk to you about gas evolution. There are some special circumstances that can come about that we need to produce a gas. You observe some of them in lab, where you mix two things together and it bubbled up. If you ever made a baking soda vinegar volcano, that's a gas evolution reaction. So these are just nothing more than those same kind of ion exchanges that we've done before. Plus, minus, plus. What's sulfur's charge? You can tell from this formula. Yeah. Okay. So whenever we have a sulfide, let's do an acid plus a sulfide. That's what S minus is, sulfide, right? What will the H combine with? The S, yeah. What formula will come from that? H2S. Why H2S? Why not just HS? Yeah, you need to balance the charges. Turns out that H2S is a gas. Okay? So, if you just remember, H2S is a gas. It's called hydrogen sulfide. It is a horrible, rotten egg-smelling, nasty gas. Okay? That's just a gaseous product. It'll bubble up. So an acid and a sulfide will make that gas plus NaCl. Balance it. Hydrogen sulfide gas. So, yeah.
Good question. Is that what you put in natural gas?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
I think it actually is. It's that nasty smelling. Yeah. So, natural gas, methane itself has no odor, so they put something really stinky in it that just at a very low concentration has a very low threshold of detection by your human nose. So, yeah, that's right.
The gas is still bad for you.
What's that?
The gas is still bad for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They just do that so you know that you're being poisoned instead of just keeling over. So, here I have an acid, and what is the SO3-2- ion called? Sulfite. So here's sodium sulfite. If I do the exchange reaction, I get these two products, H2SO3 and NaCl. H2SO3 is special because it breaks up into two things. Breaks up into H2O and SO2. Any guesses on what phase SO2 is? So, in writing the actual products for this, we'd have H2O, SO2,
and still that NaCl. Here.
Sulfur dioxide is another poisonous gas with a nasty smell to it. Yep. Your molecular equation will actually be this. So write these as your products. If you'd like to put these two first and then another arrow in those three products, that's fine too. Okay? So, last one is very similar. Instead of SO3, we have CO3. What ion is the CO3 2 minus ion? Carbonate. An acid plus carbonate. One product will be H2. Well, comparing to these ones, the original product will be what? H2?
CO3.
CO3. And NaCl.
But H2CO3 is unstable, just like H2SO3 is. H2CO3 will form what? And what?
CO2.
So, this is the similar to the baking soda vinegar, right? Vinegar is acetic acid, baking soda is bicarbonate, HCO3, but you'll get the same H2CO3, which splits apart and forms those forms the CO2 gas. Okay? So you do the same sort of thing here where you'd have H2O, CO2, NaCl. Okay. We didn't get to redox today. So what I'm going to do, we'll do redox at the start next time. Means I need to extend your mastering chemistry because there's redox in there. So let's make both the lab and the mastering chemistry do Wednesday next week. Just because we didn't get to redox today. Shucks, right? Don't have to have an assignment due on Friday. Man, I was planning on getting it done by Friday. Why can't it just be done then, right? That's what you're all saying. So, yeah. So I'll change both the lab due date and the mastering chemistry due date to Wednesday of next week so we can talk about redox at the beginning of Monday. I probably won't get too many arguments from that. So I'll change the announcements. Then, so have a good weekend. But that doesn't get you off the hook for the assignment. Work on the mastering chemistry. There's a titration problem in there. Do that one. Okay?